Welcome to the Third Hour, a Latter-day Saint home study podcast. This season, we're discussing the Hebrew Bible. Our goals? To improve our appreciation of the gospel, to investigate the scriptures more thoroughly, to discuss tricky passages, and to build our faith. Some of our talking points will be familiar. Others will sound new. That's okay. Together, we'll learn something new about the Hebrew Bible, no matter our starting level. Welcome again to the Third Hour podcast. We're glad to have you. You are listening to episode 44 of the Third Hour podcast, Chronicles. I'm your host, Taylor.
Amanda.
I'm Andrew.
This week we are covering, well, all of both 1st and 2nd Chronicles, kind of, and also specifically 1st Chronicles 15 through 17 and 19 through 21, 2nd Chronicles 1, 6 through 7, 10 through 11, 13, 29 through 30, and 34 through 36.
Yes, that.
I feel like you have the hardest job this episode, Amanda. You want to synopsize that for us?
So we start with David. So we start our selections with David entering Jerusalem with the Ark. Only the Chronicles has the Levites handling it, so there are no face-melting problems this time. David is presented in the text as a priest. We ignore all that angst with Michal, and we sing praises to God who promises to protect David and his line. We have the Ammonite war that David sits out, and the chronicler totally skips over Bathsheba, Tamar, Absalom, and all the interesting things. Well, interesting. David's big sin is conducting a census. And as you remember, because I still cannot get over it, God gives David three choices for punishment, and he chooses plague for everybody. Then people start dying, and he feels bad and offers a sacrifice, like the death was a surprise. Then we shift to Solomon, and the chronicler makes him David's chosen heir, so there's none of King's succession trouble. Then Solomon dedicates the temple, focuses on Jerusalem as the spiritual center, and warns people to be good or get destroyed. Then there's Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And I hope that you, as I, flinch as I say that, because we're back to this mess where everyone's deposing and murdering everyone and their names rhyme like the worst Dr. Seuss book ever. But it's okay because the chronicler only cares about Judah. So we've got Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and he's king. Then Jeroboam comes back from exile and asks Rehoboam to treat the people better, and Rehoboam basically just flips him off. So Jeroboam and Israel leave the kingdom. Then Rehoboam starts off well with fortifying cities and welcoming priests who fled Israel, but then goes downhill and gets invaded by Egypt. In Chronicles, that takes a whole chapter of invasion instead of a few verses. We move to Abijah, whose story goes from a verse to a whole chapter. He fights against Jeroboam and wins because he's faithful. We skip over several bad kings and get to Hezekiah, who the chronicler adores. Hezekiah fights with the Assyrian king, as he does in Kings. But the chronicler cares a lot more about Hezekiah's reforms and rebuilding the temple. Hezekiah destroys false altars and has a national Passover that includes Israel. Finally, Josiah. He purges false gods, repairs the temple, issues reforms, has another Passover that the chronicle describes in plenty of detail, and then Josiah gets killed by Egypt, and the chronicler doesn't really care about the last four kings, but they're included because this is quote-unquote history.
Nice.
That was fantastic.
Good. I worked real hard on it.
Last line was just was perfect.
It seems like, so quote unquote, is your...
is that your impression?
Yes, actually. It feels, and like, this is not a perfect analogy, but it's the best one I can come up with because I really focused on my summary instead of my impression this time. It felt like the high school version of a history textbook, whereas I don't...
That just makes me sad for high school students.
But you remember. Whereas like Samuel and Kings, I don't want to call the college version of a history textbook, but like there was blood and mistakes and nitty gritty and human beings being human beings in the history before. And this feels very smoothed out.
It reminds me of in middle school when we took Utah history, like you had to in seventh grade, and they're like, and the Mormon settlers were really, really great with the Indians.
Yes.
And then you
because they're terrified of all the parents.
And then you read like any other book and you're like, oh, that's.
That seems more accurate. That's
an interesting way of saying
that was sometimes true. Like,
yeah. Sometimes I have good impulses every now and then.
Yeah. Like, oh, wow. Like really enthusiastically taking part in like the Comanche slave trade. Yeah. I don't know. Good relationships with some, I guess.
Well, yeah.
My impression, in a weird way, was like relief. Because even if this particular arc of the history of Israel is made up out of whole cloth, at least it got made up out of whole cloth 2,000 years ago. Like, at least now I know, like, where the version that I heard in Sunday school kind of comes from. And I'm actually kind of fascinated by, I feel like the arc of the story that we tell comes from Chronicles, and yet we always quote, like, quote-unquote gems from Samuel and Kings, which I don't entirely understand. Like, I don't remember quoting Chronicles almost ever.
No.
But this is the story I was taught.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I find that really fascinating. And it was at least, it was actually kind of helpful to be like, oh, like, this actually does come from somewhere. Because when we were reading Samuel and Kings, I was just like, where did that story come from?
This is brand new information. Yes. Before Taylor gets us started, we wanted to let any listeners who've been nervous know we're okay. We were not okay for a while. We had COVID like dominoes.
Yeah, one of, in serial, not in parallel.
Yeah.
And then when we got through the COVIDs, Andrew got strep.
Yeah. And none of us gave COVID to each other, which is a small plus. That's better than the alternative. But yes, it was just,
I guess.
But so don't worry. There was a reason we had, you haven't heard from us for a while.
There was a reason we disappeared for 2 months.
Yes. Yeah. It wasn't on purpose. And we did keep trying. And then someone else got COVID. And
yeah. And then it was Thanksgiving.
And then it was
or somewhere in the middle of all that. I can't remember anymore.
It was
somewhere. So I just know we were all healthy, but out of town for 1 week.
Yeah. 1 week. But so we appreciate your patience, and we wanted you to know we were thinking about you, and we tried, but the plague won this round against all of us. We all lost.
Well, the thing is, when I was offered three options, when an angel of the Lord appeared and said, all right.
That was good, Andrew.
You've been speaking bad about the holy book. Is that what the angel said?
And I was like, you know what? Why don't we give everyone plague instead of me absorbing the consequences of my own actions?
That's good, Andrew. That was really good. I'm really proud of you for that one.
Thank you.
So should we dive into the... Well, actually, we should probably talk about where the text comes from first.
Probably.
Like authorship, dating, etc.
So, I mean, some of this will come up as we go through, but it is useful to point out that we have a really good idea of when this comes from, and that it is post the return from exile. So probably around the time of Ezra and Nehemiah at the very earliest, probably a little later. There's a lot of reasons for that. This refers to the return very explicitly. Mm-hmm. That's pretty obvious. It talks about Adam. This is actually one of the only places in the entire Hebrew Bible that we get Adam, which is a pretty late addition. You'll notice that we've had other creation myths that tend to be more of like, there is like this chaotic wind on the waters and there's weird monsters in the waters and God comes along and breathes on the waters and punches some monsters. And so...
I like that one better.
So is there a distinction there? Because I feel like I remember seeing the word Adam in Genesis. Is there a different Hebrew word that's being used here? Is more a proper noun and that's more like a son of dirt kind of thing? Or?
No, so Genesis is you might recall that just in the first chapter of Genesis, two different creation stories.
Right.
And the first one where we get this notion of Adam is kind of bolted over the top.
Right.
Of a creation myth with God, that it seems like Adam is sort of a later addition.
Okay. Right.
And there's a lot of places where if you're reading King James, you might see the word Adam, and that is a Christian or Second Temple Jewish interpolation of a term, because Adam basically can be read as man or mankind. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, in we'll talk about this many weeks down the line, But when we read Job, there's a reference to Adam in there in many translations. That does not actually say Adam. It just says man. So in general, when you, and so King James can make that wishy-washy where people are like, oh no, but Adam shows up. No, that's not accurate. There's no indication that that's a proper noun, that it's a name. That's pretty much a redaction. That's more modern than the Bible you're working from.
So having stuff like Adam for the chronicler to pull from, and I'm going to get to the chronicler in a minute, for the chronicler to pull from suggests that he's got like later books to be pulling from as he puts this history together.
Yeah, and later myths, okay, and sort of incorporating myths that perhaps the Jewish people had absorbed while in Babylon and then later while in Persia. But that's, I mean, there's all sorts of things, right? Like it begins with a genealogy, First Chronicles chapter 1. And notice that in many ways that we're moving more towards a universalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not only is this like a special regional group that was chosen by God, but it specifically descended from Adam.
Right.
There's kind of this notion of a global family in which Israel just happens to be a special member of that family. All of this stuff that has happened with them returning. So so with this great Davidic line, that this is the culmination of God's great plan. It's giving them a position in history that was previously a little less present. Now, they always had a position in history, right? Like the Lord, Hashem, has been more and more a God of history and had these great overarching plans. But in the earliest stories, he's more reactive.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of disappearing.
Yeah.
Now, God always planned for this to happen, for this kingdom to be in this particular configuration, and then to be destroyed, and then to be remade. And so we're getting this pretty late. There's a reason why in the Hebrew Bible canon, this is the last book.
Oh.
Yeah, that's actually how it is in my copy.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Because I've got a Jewish study Bible, yeah.
And its author, we can discern quite a few of its author's rhetorical goals. And I don't know if you want me to say those up front or point them out as we go. I could just rattle off like...
I think listing them off quickly now and then pointing them out as we come to them makes sense.
Okay, so the author, for one thing, so first of all, identity, right? Like post-exile, Ezra, Nehemiah time period at earliest, maybe a little later. So now talk about the goals. So whoever this is, he wants to establish the legitimacy of the kingly line. Some of the ways he's going to do that is he's going to kind of airbrush the story.
Kind of.
Some of the moral complexities are going to go out. David and Solomon are seen as kind of equivalent to really give you this idea of this united monarchy, right? Mm-hmm. That it was great. It was wonderful. All the problems kind of disappear. And we'll really, I have a great list that I want to share with you later about like how David changes from the previous narrative we've read. Another one is he wants to establish the priesthood as a central authority. So like Amanda pointed out, it's the Levites who carry the ark.
Yeah.
When there's a deposition of a former king, the Levites are front and center. In fact, the Levites even exist.
Yeah.
Right? Previously, they did not. You kind of get this other notion of a priesthood, right? You get the kind of...
Melchizedek weird.
Yeah, we got like, the Zadokite priesthood.
Yeah.
And now it's this Levitical notion. Most scholars do agree that the Levitical priesthood was a later addition that was kind of inserted backwards because who's writing the books and who's transmitting the books. So whoever this is very much wants to establish the Levitical priesthood as a major axis of authority, probably because he was a part of it.
Yeah.
He was a priest, almost certainly.
Yeah.
Another one is there's this notion of the northern kingdom. There's a lot of exhortation for them to be included in their idea of a united Israel. And when we're talking about Israel, we remember that they're creating a notion of Israel. There is no single Israel. We are always creating ideas about what Israel is. And in this one, the northern kingdom is not quite so scattered. It's still up in the north. It's just sort of disparate and broken. And we're going to see this author do a lot of things to kind of try to bring them down into the south and restart the Israel project under Judahite rule.
Right. Which really ties in nicely to the whole Davidic line obsession, where you're really emphasizing how great it was when we were all together under a Davidic king. Let's do it again.
Yeah. And the last major rhetorical goal I would point out is that probably because this person is a priest in a time period when they're thinking a lot more about like theology, we get like a lot more cleaned up theology. God is tamed quite significantly. We get a Satan figure instead of God doing terrible things. It's like Satan who tempts David to do a census instead of God.
Oh. Yeah, because it's worth remembering that in Samuel or Kings, whichever one it's in, yeah, God explicitly commands David to do it and then punishes him for it.
Correct. So now Satan is the one doing it. And you see this in a few places. Like, God is directly retributive. So like Reuben, for instance, why is Reuben not listed first, even though he's the oldest son? Well, here, Chronicles just invents this thing. We're like, well, because of Reuben's sexual sins, he loses his birthright. And so God has this direct retribution, and that's why Judah is favored over Reuben. But we don't see that anywhere else.
It's just amazing to me how these authors can pick and choose when sexual sins are sexual sins and when they're just normal.
Yeah. Yep. Right. But so we're going to get kind of like the theology is a little more universal. The God is a little more universal. He has better plans. They work out better. He doesn't tempt people to do bad things.
He has plans.
He has plans at all. Yeah. Instead of being very reactive, and you can like browbeat him into not destroying people. So a lot of development. So those are kind of the goals of the author. That's kind of what we can glean out of the text. Obviously, we don't know a lot of concrete stuff. But that's something that is good to keep in mind as we go.
So as we kind of jump into the text itself, we'll skip pretty quickly through the first 14 chapters since that's not what we were focused on. But I do think it's worth mentioning that like Saul is amazingly absent. So I think we start once we already have gotten to David. But the only mention of Saul we get is really he gets mentioned in the genealogy in chapter 9. And then in verse 10, he's not even really called a king. He just gets killed in the battle with the Philistines. And
all of his sons die.
And all of his sons die.
So yeah. There's no murdering happening in this story. David's on the other side of the country. It's fine.
Yeah, there's no Ish-bosheth. There's none of the complications that marked the previous narrative.
And I feel like the transitional sentence just sums up this author's approach really well. Saul died for having fulfilled Saul died for the trespass that he had committed against the Lord in not having fulfilled the command of the Lord. Moreover, he had consulted a ghost to seek advice and did not seek advice of the Lord. So he, God, had him slain and the kingdom transferred to David, son of Jesse.
That's 10:13-14.
Yeah. Just so clean. God killed him for these sins.
Yep.
Yeah. And thankfully, David will not commit any sins.
Yeah,
in this narrative,
he just does a census. Andrew, gosh, it's fine. Just a census.
That's true. There is the census, but yeah. So then we jump ahead, and we're really picking up the narrative in 15, which David's kind of been around for a little while at this point, but he's solidifying his power with the ark coming back to Jerusalem because things have gone wrong, and he decides that's why. The Levites bring it, and we have this big celebration in chapter 16. I did also feel like there's a sort of jubilant feeling to Chronicles that's been absent in other texts. Does anyone else pick up on that? Or is that just, I know there's lots of singing and praising and excitement. Whereas in a lot of the other texts, even the praising and the sacrifice is all about like abasement and like trying to get back in God's good graces. This just feels more, I don't know.
One of my footnotes makes the argument, which I found very interesting, and I'm going to seize as my own, in the Book of Psalms probably existed and possibly was already attributed to David, according to one of my footnotes.
Oh.
Which makes me just kind of like narratively wonder if you would include lots of singy business, because that's already like if that's tied into the David mythos of just a cherubic farm boy who really liked playing his harp and God made him king and everybody just accidentally fell on his sword. It's fine. He was singing about it. That you would choose to include lots of those bits and pieces because they're just tied in with the David mythos. I don't know if there's anything to that, but I It was one of those real interesting footnotes.
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes some sense to me. I don't know if there's anything to it either. You care to comment, Andrew?
So most scholars agree on that, yeah.
Yeah.
At least portions of the Psalms.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, then we go through the rule of King David. Is this where we get in the list? Because I just feel like this is the cleanest reign.
So let me give you a list.
No Bathsheba.
Let me give you a list. So I have two lists here. One is a David is, and the other one is David is not. So, and this is a comparative list from the narrative we read in Samuel and Kings. So first of all, David is a builder.
Yeah.
He does a lot of building projects. David is blessed with lots of wives and children. Now he had some before, but now it's kind of this vague thing. David is famous among foreign nations. Previously, most foreign nations hadn't heard of him.
Other than the ones he betrayed.
David is respectful of the Levitical priest's role in the kingdom. David is a consistent psalter. And like psalms.
Psalms, not salt.
Yeah.
David is the gatherer of the temple materials. Now, here's what David is not. This list is a little longer. David is not a vassal for the Philistine king Agag. David is not a madman who rolls around on the ground. David is not a canny politician. David is not someone who parades naked. David is not an adulterer with Bathsheba. David is not a murderer of Uriah. David is not a mob boss who orders hits on his deathbed. David is not someone who wears the priestly ephod. David is not threatened with divine discipline. David is not beset by Saul's successors. David is not a terrible father who overlooks the rape of Tamar and Absalom killing Amnon and the resultant eventual rebellion. And that's all the fun stuff.
So do we, I mean, we've kind of already said this is has an obvious rhetorical purpose of propping up the Davidic line. Do we want to add more to it than that?
No, I just think it's worthwhile that people know kind of the depth of how clean this narrative is.
Yeah.
So
there's no possible way you can answer this, but it's what I've been wondering the entire time. Do we think the chronicler is hoping that this shall supplant the stuff in Kings and Samuel and become the new narrative that everybody knows? Or is it just, we're not really concerned about that business because we're concerned about all these good kings and like, you all know this crap that David did. I don't need to repeat it. It's not supporting my cause.
Yeah, we really don't know. What we do know is that the canon is not built, right? It is not assembled. We haven't sorted out what will be included and what will not be included. And we know that plenty of materials that are included eventually in the canon of what becomes the Hebrew Bible go missing.
Yeah.
There's no reason to expect that this could not have been seen as a replacement, potentially. Like you said, we don't know.
Yeah.
But it seems like that this is trying to be an authoritative statement on a whole bunch of things. And that maybe its author didn't want it to come across as contradicting another text. And that eventually, and we're talking, you know, a few hundred years later, that the fact that it contradicts so thoroughly is one of the reasons it's included. Because it's seen as, in some ways, not only because it contradicts, but because it could be seen as a corrective. And we'll see plenty of ways that it sort of modifies previous stories, like with Reuben, right?
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
previously maybe you're like, well, why does Reuben not get listed first in this very patriarchal society with, you know, pretty obvious primogeniture? He's primogeniture. Should be first. And this kind of answers that. So you could see this as an appendix on the other story where it's clarifying some things. But it always seems to clarify toward a very particular political purpose.
Yeah. You know?
And speaking of that, my sense is that this is also, like, it's not just the narrative that won in our day. Like, and I'm trying to remember from reading the New Testament, but I feel like the David that shows up in the New Testament is more like the one in Chronicles than the one in Kings.
Yes.
So this narrative wins, basically. I mean, that one of my impressions is, like, this narrative won.
For many people, the idea that you're going to be so fond of this kingdom that was really collapsing the instant it was born.
Yeah.
It was corrupt. It was riddled with civil war. It was a miserable place. You kind of do just have to rewrite the whole thing in order to be like, oh, and we're restoring that kingdom. So everyone's like, cool. Instead of like, oh, like that hellish, like court intrigue, nasty, like, you know, sexually complicated. Like, didn't David maybe have a gay lover? Like, like really complicated story. This is like the founding myth. Okay, this is like,
yeah,
and the founding fathers all got along.
And yeah. I just immediately thought, was it George Washington and the apple tree? Who was the one with the apple tree?
I think it was Washington.
Yeah.
Or was it? It was Washington.
Yeah, could not tell a lie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We still have our founding myths. Like,
yeah. Like this is the myth that like people tell themselves now about America. We're like, what did the founders intend? And you're like, well, maybe the founders all intended different things and regularly argued.
Yeah.
And like the Constitution was like barely cobbled together with careful omissions around pretty important issues to appease certain colonies. You know, this is the version that's like, woohoo, America. Those black people were taught great skills.
Nope, moving on. Solomon.
I think it's a fair comparison. So then, like, near the end of David, we do have his one mistake, which I feel like is worth pointing out, where, you know, and we've already said it, Satan, not God, who incites David to number Israel, which I think we've talked in prior episodes. It's worth re-mentioning that there's this sort of superstition that if you count people,
yeah,
you're going to bring a plague.
Yes, and it's a desert superstition. So it's kind of goofy that, like, it's still a thing.
What do you mean by desert? Just, like, meaning nomadic people
in
the desert?
Yeah, this is like this really old nomadic Semitic myth. You know, like, Israel today does censuses.
Yeah. And you mentioned Satan has arisen as a new figure. Like, how defined is Satan at this point compared to the way we think about Satan? Is it worth digging into that a little bit, or is that too tangential?
I think it's useful to at least point out that who Satan is switching. Now, previously, we get the sense that God, first of all, that it's okay for God to kind of have an adversarial relationship anyway.
Yeah,
and
with
now,
everything.
Yeah, not only to the opponents of Israel, but also to the children of Israel themselves.
Right. Yeah.
That God is constantly like tempting people and mind controlling people. And,
right. You
know, like, well, I want to prove that you're bad, so I'm going to force you to do evil. And you're like, I don't know if that shows that guy's bad.
Does that count?
Like, you know, the guy with the strings is making the puppet jump. But there was this notion that God had this extended court,
right,
that mirrors the earthly court of kings, right? That because God had a family, God had a consort, God was very much like us in the earliest tellings, yeah, including a court, a retinue of helpers.
Right.
And so there is this idea of that God, for instance, had the accuser. And this is who appears, for instance, in Job, is that the accuser comes and talks to God. Now, we later commentators, when this becomes Satan, are going to turn themselves into a cosmological pretzel to be like, well, why is God wagering with Satan?
Right.
Like, aren't you more uncomfortable with the fact that God will, like, destroy your family in a wager with Satan than that maybe it was an earlier way of thinking about God and his angels? That the accuser was just one of God's angels, and he comes and asks this question about, like, well, the accuser is in charge of, like, punishing people, right? And the accuser's like, well, clearly Job's good because, you know, you give him blessings.
Yeah.
So how can I judge whether he's good or not, basically?
It's like the first episode of The Good Place.
Yeah. Right. And so there's this notion that God's court is kind of becoming the notion of angels and devils and all of that sort of thing. Whereas previously, were there devils? Sure. There were monsters. There were giants. There were horrible things.
Azazel.
It was Azazel.
I'm never going to get over that.
That is one of my favorite ones, too.
And there were other gods. But now as it becomes more universal, there can only be really one God. And so what happens to those other gods? Well, rather than just being people who are kind of co-equal, you know, God's rivals or people that our God is maybe a little stronger than, suddenly they become devils.
Yeah.
And so we're at a certain point in that development. Now, it is not complete. It is still developing, but at least we're getting the idea that it's an external tempter who comes and is like, hey, David, count all of the people.
Yeah. And my sense is it won't reach like a recognizable Christian form until like after the, well into early Christianity, second, third century.
Yes.
Yeah. So Satan convinces David to take a census. And as we've already established, when given three choices, what were the three choices exactly? Let's see. Let's say to the Lord, select for yourself.
21:12.
A 3-year famine, or that you be swept away 3 months before your adversaries with the sword or of your enemies overtaking you, or 3 days of the sword of the Lord, pestilence in the land, the angel of the Lord wreaking destruction throughout the territory of Israel. So I guess they're all bad for everyone in a way.
Nah, David can get chased for 3 months.
I assume that really means his armies.
Well, yeah, but they're kind of bad too. Like, or at least they're used to running around.
Yeah.
Yes, that's all they did for a whole book before. Yeah,
that's right. So we get this pestilence. David stops it with a sacrifice. And at the place that happens, he decides that's where the temple's going to be built. And I guess we kind of skipped over the temple. I mean, we have this there was some similarity with the temple story. David wants to build it. Nathan says, not you, but Solomon. Although David does more of it in this book than he does in Kings. But that's how in Kings, there's not this tie between the plague and the temple, but here we get this tie between where the plague ends and where the temple is built, which I feel like, how does Chronicles fall on? One of the big questions that's been coming up in other texts is, do we have to worship in Jerusalem? Right? Like the centrality of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
It seems like this is embracing that. And this is kind of an explanation of one of the reasons why.
Yes.
Well, especially if we're post return, we would be all about that.
Yes. Yeah. So you might remember that Cyrus of Persia has basically said, okay, you're going to return and be one of my vassals. And Jerusalem is what I'm going to rebuild for you and build your temple.
Yeah.
And so this is where we probably get a huge portion of that unifying narrative that like everything is centralized here. Now, remember, we have absolutely no archaeological evidence for the first temple. And so there is a chance that the Samaritan narrative is correct and that it's on Mount Gerizim and not on Mount Zion.
And there's not archaeological evidence for it in either site?
No, but there is evidence of a temple on Mount Gerizim.
Oh, okay.
Now, it is not as old as the first temple would be,
okay. But
there is evidence of ongoing cultic practice there. I mean, there's a third temple, too, and we've mentioned this, I think. But there's also a third temple in Elephantine in Egypt.
Oh, yes, you mentioned it.
So there's another Jewish community that at least has a temple pretty much later, right?
Yeah.
Like relatively late in the game. And so we know of at least three Jewish temple, well, not Jewish, but Israelite temple communities.
Right.
And so, but post-exile is where we're getting a lot of the doubling down on Jerusalem.
Yeah. And it feels like an important time to emphasize that Cyrus is probably one of the benefactors of this narrative.
Yes.
Because like you say, he's providing the funds, he's sending them back. He's propping people up in Jerusalem, and this is propping those people up.
This will be written on parchment paid for by Cyrus with ink paid for by Cyrus, via quills paid for by Cyrus in a court defended by Cyrus's soldiers and treasuried by Cyrus.
And very few people have the cojones to write opposite to that.
Well, and guess what? Guess who doesn't get criticized?
Yeah.
So, and there is this idea of the universalizing impulse could in part be a means of flattering Cyrus.
Right.
This idea that, well, we're God's chosen people, but anyone who helps us, they must be part of God's plan.
Yeah.
And to Cyrus, who's building this huge syncretic empire, right? Who he doesn't really care about the local observances as long as they're going along.
Right.
And they say, well, we've got the best god. Everyone's saying that.
Right.
No one's like, we got the dippy god. And so they're saying, we have the best god. And who should be the enactor of his plan eventually? But this guy.
Yeah.
That's a really flattering narrative. So this is very likely meant to be a flattering court narrative.
And we have to talk about it in seminary 2,000 years later.
But not with any degree of like accuracy.
Yeah. I know,
like,
which makes it worse.
They're just like, see, and that's why Reuben was listed later. And you're like, oh, I'm sure.
Well, when I was in high school, I was like, oh, that makes sense. Maybe you were skeptical. I hadn't learned to be skeptical yet.
Well, now I'm just...
I was eating it up.
I was eating Skittles secretly.
Like, why didn't you share with me?
Like, under the table, just like, man, I'm so tired. I just pop these Skittles.
Stupid early morning.
So then we transition to Solomon, who is, again, doesn't mess up. I mean, I think at the end of... Solomon's reign before, he has problems with idolatry, and none of that shows up here.
Nope.
Although the contrast for David is just so glaring that Solomon doesn't feel as bad. But
yeah.
Well, I feel like part of it is that Solomon had like four verses, and I know not literally four verses, but he just had this pittance of stuff about him in the first place, and it was all super complimentary. And then you could blame his wife for the idolatry. And we moved right along. And so it's like, yeah, it's fine. It's another four verses about how great he is and women are the worst. They're nodding. You can't hear them, but they're nodding.
I was trying to think, like, what word expresses, like, my, yeah, nod, like, my, yeah.
I mean, we get some small changes, right? Like, instead of being wealthy later in his reign, so you get this kind of sense in the king's version that he's, like, becoming corrupted. By his wealth. Here he has the wealth up front so that he can build the temple with it.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to see all sorts of little minor changes that do present something a bit different.
There's no succession crisis. Bathsheba doesn't have to put him in power.
Yeah. Like, the temple is slightly different. He gives, like, a speech in chapter 6. So we get this notion that instead of a covenant, and this is important, right? Because we've talked about becoming Israel.
Yeah.
And that every one of these texts presents a different idea of what it means to build Zion.
Right.
And that they're all very contingent on their time and place and the politics of their people. And in this one, the covenant is a contemporary document, right? It's this notion of something that's being forged now. And he uses this phrase, I think it's in, so we're in chapter 6. Is it in 16? Where there's a pretty big difference. Yeah, so in 16. So this is part of the dedication prayer, which is kind of a reforging of the covenant. And he talks about, he's talking about the Lord God of Israel, to keep your servant for your father, blah, blah, blah. And there's a change of phrase here. Previously, the Lord had said, walk before me. And now he says, walk in my law as you have walked before me. And so it changes. Instead of this idea of kind of like a nebulous righteousness, it becomes there's a very concrete law that they have to follow. So the covenant now is a little bit more legalistic. Mm-hmm. And what does that law have to do with? Well, does it have to do with cultic paraphernalia? Not so much. It has to do with following the king. Things have sort of shifted.
I feel bad for the poor doctoral student who at some point had all of these two versions.
Yeah, read these speeches side by side.
Laid out side by side, like highlighting, crossing out. And they probably loved every minute.
And I also, I mean, I feel like, I don't know how much this is the same as before, but I do see a lot of the idea of God being big, you know, verse 18, does God really dwell with man on earth? Even the heavens, their uttermost reaches cannot contain you. How much less this house that I have built. So he finishes the prayer. The house is sanctified. Fire comes down from heaven.
And then to pay for the temple. Previously, you might remember that he had to pay Hiram 20 cities.
Yeah.
This time that doesn't happen. Hiram gives him cities.
Good reminder. Totally forgot about that.
Well, that tells you something alone, right?
Yeah.
This means that this is sufficiently distant from the narrative that, like, some neighboring king isn't going to be like, hey.
Those are my cities. Those,
you're lying about the cities. Yeah, there's no, like, Hiram of Tyre to, like, get mad at them now.
Right. So do we want to say anything more about Solomon before we move on?
I mean, we also omit, like, so Queen of Sheba shows up, of course, but we omit, like, these problematic foreign marriages.
Mm, mm-hmm. Right.
Like, so his really big, like, being, like, big problems sort of disappear.
Women be the worst.
Women are the worst, man. Women, I guess.
Yep. Not even wearing a hat. I'm not putting my hood on. Can't
yeah, so that concludes the third division of Chronicles.
Oh yeah, we didn't talk about the divisions. Do you want to lay out what the major divisions are?
So chapter 1, First Chronicles 1 through 9 is like the wacky genealogies. Then we get David for the rest of First Chronicles. Second Chronicles 1 through 9 is Solomon. And then the rest is when we get basically the separation of kingdoms all the way to the captivity. So it's likely, remember, this isn't really two books, right?
Yeah.
This is one book. But likely we could think of it as four sub-books.
Right. So then we move on to this sort of moving through all these kings. And, I mean, the main theme to me here is just more of the same. Like Rehoboam, you do get a little bit of negativity with Rehoboam because you get him flipping off Jeroboam when he, you know, making a bad decision there. But, like, it super tries to soften it.
Let me see if I can find it. While you're looking for that, I'll just note that one thing where this really departs from the king's narrative is that there's a much tighter connection between a king's righteousness and the consequences. So you might remember in Kings, we had a couple instances where God would be like, wow, they're really bad, so we're going to punish their kids.
Yeah, and he would say that explicitly, like, you're going to finish reigning, but your posterity is going to be wiped
right.
out.
Yeah.
Out of my love for David.
Yeah, and kind of like, well, aren't they also descended from David? Anyway,
yeah.
Here we don't get that, right?
Genetics are complicated.
Like, the instant that Rehoboam becomes disobedient, he gets an invasion from Egypt. Then he repents, so Egypt takes tribute and runs away. We get, like, Asa, who previously was, like, not great, but here he gets, in chapter 15, here he gets persuaded into, like, having at least some minor reforms, and suddenly the war ends. But then he allies with Aram to defeat Israel, and suddenly there's wars. Like, the cause and effect is really tightly knitted here, mm-hmm. whereas previously in Kings, you could just tell that he was trying to attach divine consequences to things he didn't like, but it never quite lined up. Right.
Right.
So he was trying to explain, like, okay, this king was bad, and therefore, like, 40 years later, something bad happened.
Yeah.
Here, without any proximity to those events, he's able, the chronicler is able to make them overlay very tightly.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
And in doing that, that's actually kind of what I was going for with Rehoboam. Like, he's oscillating instead of just being all bad. And it's almost like it's to explain all the oscillations. Is it fair to say, too, that this is another theological development where we're starting to see some sense of needing God to be just in a specific way?
Yes.
Like, where the author is concerned about the injustice of punishing a child for their father's sins, and so we have to rewrite the history to get rid of that.
Yes, absolutely. So there is a developing notion about what justice means.
Yeah.
Previously, there was this idea that justice is just God's, and God is kind of alien and inscrutable.
Right.
Which totally fits with a tribal, you know, animistic model, where the reason you invent a God is to explain why random junk happens to you.
Right.
And so, like, sometimes the thunderstorm kills a kid and you're just like, well, God just did it. And God be wacky. Here, suddenly they're developing this notion that no, God is just and God is merciful and God meets out his justice and mercy in proper proportions. That's how great God is. And so now history has to be leveled from its previous, you know, where God was inscrutable. Now God is quite scrutable.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me to start to see the way, I mean, that comes from such, in some ways, like a good impulse. Like, I think it's a good impulse to try to get rid of punishing kids for their parents' mistakes. But then once you insist that the world has to work that way, then you have to make the kid that got struck by lightning evil.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
And that's like an inevitable consequence of it.
Yeah, and so you fix one problem only to create a totally different horror of ethics.
Right.
And this is actually one reason I wanted to read Chronicles directly after Samuel and Kings, because even though this is so much later, it's really useful to see them side by side so that you can just see. It's like seeing a kid for the first time, like 5 years later, and you're like, wow, you grew up fast, because you're not seeing him every day.
Right.
So seeing it like this, it's easier to be like, wow, things have really changed in the past, you know, 200 to 300 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much we want to hit all the minor kings before Hezekiah. Do we want to say anything else about those guys before we jump to Hezekiah in 29?
I don't think so. Just know that all of the weird, complicated stuff, it's all going to be very tidy. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's going to be super focused on Judah. We should maybe mention that.
Yes, that's true too.
It's really obsessed with the Davidic line. It kind of rejects, it sort of treats almost as irrelevant the Israelite kings in a way.
That's a good identification, because there's only one pericope where it switches perspective to the north, right? So we only focus on the Judahite perspective.
Yeah. So then we get to Hezekiah, which is Amanda mentioned as a favorite of the chronicler. He's kind of a favorite of the author of Kings and Samuel too, right?
Yeah, but it seems like they kind of like Josiah more.
Yeah.
Here, they're like, man, that high, you know who was better than Josiah maybe?
Yeah.
Hezekiah.
Yeah.
Because of his cool well, his walls.
His name doesn't rhyme with anybody's.
Yeah.
It's a relief.
It's a little more different.
Can pick that one.
So Hezekiah does a bunch of reforms in chapter 29 to come back to, I don't know, some imaginary better way of doing things.
Yeah, clean up the temple.
Yeah. And I noticed before all the reform, like, just to highlight the way the Levites play such a central role, because we haven't talked about it much going throughout, but, like, the first step to purifying the temple is always purifying the Levites so that they can purify the temple, because Hezekiah can't do it without them. And I feel like that actually happens kind of multiple times. They always are the prelude to...
Yeah, I mean, so notice in 29, so it's the Levites who are really the ones who are going to benefit financially. And then in 31, all of the big reforms principally benefit the priestly class. So, which is interesting, because if you're a priest and you're writing this, and you're hoping that your current king is going to like take lessons from history, and you're like, the best king ever, do you know what he did? He really enlarged and enriched us. And you kind of hope that the king is maybe not that smart, I guess.
I do sometimes wonder, like, anyway. And then having cleansed the temple, they prepare for this Passover with Israel. So we have this sort of gathering of all the tribes again. And am I remembering right that this is where, like, they have like slightly different traditions when they gather for the Passover?
They do, yeah.
And Hezekiah just tells people to overlook it, basically.
Yeah. I mean, this is also one of the, this passage also stands in such contrast to the scattering narrative, right?
Right.
Like, they're all pretty much there.
Yeah.
Like, some of them are super diminished, some of them don't get named. But for the most part, you know, lost 10 tribes, not, you know, maybe we're not like lost 4 tribes. And
would it be fair to say that it speaks to just a very different scattering and gathering narrative, where like a scattering happened and a gathering already happened again? So, I mean, that's obviously very different from the narrative we've inherited. But in a sense, there is kind of a scattering gathering happening here, right?
Yeah. And think about it in terms of what the chronicler would want you to get out of this.
Right.
Because they have come back from Persia and been settled in the remnants of Judah. But there's all these people who say that they're Israel all over the place. And so you write this narrative, and so you can see the evidence that a literal scattering of the 10 tribes has not occurred.
Right.
It is right there in your day-to-day rural agricultural life.
Yeah.
That your farmers are working side by side with farmers who say they're Reubenites.
Right.
So you can't really tell this story about like, well, we were righteous and the Reubenites got, you know, deported. You can't say that. They're right there. So instead, what you do is you actually tell a slightly more accurate story, where...
Wait, Chronicles is more accurate in a place?
In this regard, yes, probably because of political necessity.
Yeah.
Because you have those social tribes right there. So what do? So you write this version of the narrative where you say, and then he had this great Passover, and your ancestors who were left behind and had been broken by the Assyrians, he even invited them to the Passover. And the righteous ones did come to the Passover, and they kind of overlooked their religious differences because they knew Hezekiah was the dude. And so it was great in unity. And maybe you guys too should remember Hezekiah and come and join in our rituals that are kind of related to your rituals, but you'll notice they're a little different. Maybe they're a little more Persian. Let's leave that aside. But you guys should do traditions with us too.
Yeah.
And so the fact that there is a material and social reality forcing this book to acknowledge that those tribes were not, in fact, deported in their entirety, but are remaining as a landed class. That's probably what's going on here.
Yeah. Is it possible to tease out? I mean, that kind of narrative can go two ways, right? It can go, hey, like, let's reconcile and figure out how to build together. Or it can go like, hey, let's quote unquote reconcile and you do what I say. Right. And
yeah.
It's a tool of oppression. Can we tease out which is it some, I mean, maybe that's a dumb question, but I'm just kind of like, how do we think about what's happening here? How would we even go about trying to answer that question?
So first of all, I don't think we can know.
Yeah.
It was probably complicated.
Right.
And it could depend on, like, a priest in Jerusalem probably felt differently from like a Levite out living among the people.
Yeah.
And they have different goals based on where they're serving.
Yeah.
So that's probably true here. But one thing I think we need to keep in mind is that institutions can also have goals.
Yeah.
And express a sort of will. And this document seems to be an expression of that will, where whoever is writing this, the broad institution, wants unity at all costs. Mm. So it probably will be in some ways unifying and in some ways oppressive.
Yeah.
As long as it's forwarding that goal. And yeah. It doesn't really care about the little granules that slip in between.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite parts about reading this is, I don't know. It's another way of brushing fingers with people, I think. Okay, so then we jump to Josiah. I mean, we skipped a few chapters in our assigned reading.
I just want to point out, so Sennacherib, when he invades this time, notice that the temple isn't stripped. I just think that's interesting. We don't get Isaiah as an intermediary for God, like Hezekiah can just do it.
That's probably worth pointing out. Like prophets in general are like Nathan shows up with David.
Yeah.
But I feel like in a sense you could argue like it's not just that the Levites are more important, it's that the prophets have been made subservient to the Levites in a way. Is that a fair characterization, do you think?
Yes. And it's probably because whoever's writing this recognizes something that we don't today. Which is that the prophets weren't unified and they were always fighting and it was kind of a wild west.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want that because what does Cyrus want? He wants order.
Right.
And so what do they promote? Priestly order.
Yeah.
So you don't get like...
Which is like a royal class, which is going to be much more unified, much more controllable.
Yes.
Yeah.
We cannot have these prophets roaming in from the countryside talking about how terrible... You city folk are.
yeah. Like Amos.
Yeah.
All right. So then we jump to Josiah and the discovery of the temple scroll in chapter 34.
Quote unquote.
Yeah. Quote unquote.
Yeah. We talked about that before.
I still can't get over that. I still that boggles my mind.
Yeah. So maybe we should reiterate. So in 34, he's 8 years old when he's put on the throne. That almost always means puppet king.
Right. Mm-hmm. How could it not?
Well, like, even if he's not a puppet, let's say he's totally legitimate, then you still have to ask, like, okay, but who's the steward?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, who's the Madame Dowager or, you know.
Who's taking care of things while the king naps?
Right.
Yeah.
Needs a snack.
Yeah. Yeah. King stubbed his toe. He can't come to court today.
In Europe, some princes were still nursing at this age, right?
Absolutely.
That sounds European.
So do we get any other, I don't remember anything too, I mean, we discover the temple scroll also in Samuel. And we talked about that probably being Deuteronomy then.
Yeah.
Right. Do we have anything to add to that narrative here?
I mean, we get one slight change that I always feel compelled. Did you notice Huldah, who is the female prophetess to whom they take the temple scroll to, who it seems like they probably just can't erase her, that this time she has a husband.
I missed that.
And he gets
wife of Shalom, yeah.
Son of Tokath, son of
Hazra, keeper of the wardrobe. So here she's actually explicitly connected to the court. Which, so if you're thinking like, okay, well, the story of this book coming forth is so important that we have to include certain details.
Yeah.
Like Huldah.
Yeah.
But how can we tame her so that it doesn't actually give that much power to women, that she can't just be like a random prophetess too?
Right.
Well, now here she has a husband.
He gets three generations named.
And it's attached to the court.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're also part of the Levitical class.
Yeah.
So instead of her just being like this, whoa, cool woman, knows more about like books
right. than any gets dude. Gets the final say.
Yeah. She's the one who figures out what this book is. Here it's this woman who had a husband and was attached to the court.
Yeah.
Those are very important provisos on her identity. And we've talked, like in the New Testament season about how the tendency of taking women and then very carefully pruning their identity so that you're like, oh, all of Jesus's followers were related to him.
Right. Or prostitutes.
Or prostitutes. Yeah. So maybe don't emulate them.
Yeah.
Don't maybe make a cult in their name. You know? So things like that. Pretty common.
Wear hats.
Don't
read the Gospel of Mary. So then Josiah 2 will celebrate a Passover. So I feel like we're developing a theme here.
Yeah.
And then he dies because he failed to listen to the word of the Lord spoken through the king of Egypt. What was up with that? So this is 35:24. Like King Necho tells him, gives him a warning. But then he gets shot. His servants carried him out of his chariot and put him in the wagon of his second in command and conveyed him to Jerusalem. There he died and was buried in the grave of his fathers. Wait, somewhere I thought it said explicitly.
In 21 when Necho sends envoys to him and says, God has commanded me to hurry. Cease opposing God who is with me so that he will not destroy you.
Yeah, and then it goes on in 22. He went to fight him heedless of Necho's words from the mouth of God. So that's why he gets
Yeah, and so, I mean, Necho is almost certainly not invoking the Lord.
Right.
But this narrative can't acknowledge that, you know, Necho is like, well, Ross sent me.
Yeah. Right, because it's got this universalizing impulse.
Right. Now, we are going to get Cyrus name dropped, right? Like, so we blip over this entire collapse.
Right. 36 kind of has it. And we do name the kings, sort of.
Yeah.
And then it's just over.
And then we make it to 36:22 in the first year of King Cyrus of Persia. And then the fulfillment of the Lord.
Yeah. And like you said, Andrew, it makes him the Lord roused the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia to issue a proclamation throughout his realm. And this is where it matches. Is it Ezra or Nehemiah?
Yeah, it's Ezra.
Ezra.
Yeah, it's identical to the first verses of Ezra.
Right.
Where thus says King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. It seems like Cyrus had kind of figured out what the Romans did later, right? That one of the easiest ways to conquer all of these disparate religions is to just be like, you know what? Your God is Jupiter. We have the same God.
Yeah.
And kind of emphasize the similarities, sand away the differences. But anyway, the fact that Cyrus is the fulfillment of everything in Chronicles, I think should make us a little aware of what's at stake here.
Yeah, maybe a listener who hasn't read it was wondering like why we're talking so much about Cyrus, but I feel like it's these last verses that make it so, like, this is what the whole thing's been building up to, right?
Yeah.
It is indeed squiffy.
Yeah. I don't know what squiffy means.
I don't either, but that's the word I've got for it. squishy.
Stop trying to make fetch happen.
It's streets ahead, Andrew.
Oh, that's right. I'm streets behind.
So we said that Chronicles is written a little bit after Ezra and Nehemiah, right?
Yeah.
So is this like an endorsement of Ezra and Nehemiah? Is this the author saying, like, now go read those books?
Yeah, so remember I said that it's probably written at earliest in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. So you'll find different opinions on that. So it could be that whoever's writing this, that Ezra is also part of the same priestly program.
Right.
And they're meant to be a segue or whatever.
Yeah.
Or it could be that it is a callback.
Yeah. It would be interesting when we get to Ezra and Nehemiah. I want to try to remember. Because there are some differences too, right? They're a little more ethnocentric even than Chronicles.
Yes. I mean, let me even propose this. It's possible that this ending, the way that Ezra begins, might be meant to put it before Ezra.
Oh.
That the author is like, here's a prologue to Ezra. Mm-hmm. Now read Ezra in the context of this book. That's very universal. Less xenophobic.
Trying to soften the xenophobia.
Yeah, that it might have a different rhetorical goal from Ezra.
You've actually given me a couple of reasons to like Chronicles.
There are reasons to like Chronicles.
Bless its heart.
Yeah, bless its heart.
Besides just that it was like super comfortable to read because I didn't have to like... They didn't want it.
Yes, but it being comfortable to read is now uncomfortable. Yeah,
I agree.
And that stupid podcast, every time I'm comfortable with my scriptures, I'm like, oh, but what did I miss? What did I accidentally skip over?
It's the problem, right? Like now when you're fed pablum, you're like, this is really plain.
Yeah.
What pill did you put in it?
Yeah.
What am I swallowing?
It's true.
I don't want
to. The whole Sunday school lesson is based on John writing 2 John. You're just like, well. I don't know what to do with this.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Third Hour Podcast.
We also thank you for your patience.
Thank you for joining us. This was the Third Hour, a Latter-day Saint home study podcast. If you felt any impressions or had any comments, we would love to hear them at thethirdhourpodcast.com. We'll see you next time.